welcome to this latest lunchtime session with DPP. My name is Ollie Ripp, I'm your host, I'm joined as ever by Phil Brining and David Holmes. Good afternoon, chaps.
Good afternoon, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, good afternoon.
We've also got Miles on camera this week because we're going to be running our prize draw very shortly for some free support time. So for those who may remember, we ran a couple of GDPR workshops when was it? Last month, was it, Miles?
Yeah.
And all those who attended both sessions were entered into a prize draw to win some free support time with our support desk. So we shall get to that very shortly. Just so you're aware, we do record these sessions to put them out afterwards in the form of a podcast. The privacy notice was on the screen. We'll flash that up again very shortly. Any issues with that at all, do let us know. GDPR radio this week, so just an informal chat about what's been in the news, data protection-wise, privacy-wise, anything anyone's been working on of interest, anything that we want to kick around. As ever, as much your sessions as they are ours, so please do contribute any comments, questions, just pop them in the chat or unmute, dive in, and we'll kick things around. Right, without further ado, Miles, I'll leave you the floor for this this prize draw.
Thank you very much. So yeah, thank you to everyone who entered. We've got a bucket full of names here, all different. So I'm going to just pick a random one out of this bucket, give it a good shake. And
it's a washing up bowl, not a bucket.
Well, I've told everyone it's a hat, so it's a bucket is more of an accurate description. Andrea Sovu, is that how you say it? Yeah, Sovu, Andrea. So that's the winning ticket there. So well done. So you'll win 3 hours, 10 hours of free data protection support. So Rob will be in touch with you. Rob will be in touch with you after this session to set all that up. So well done for winning that. We are going to run, two more competitions. So we're going to run another one again for our SARS and FOIA session, which is next month. I'll be sending invites out to that soon. So, keep your eye out for that one. And then we'll have another one coming up shortly as well. So, I'll give you all the details. And if you want to enter next time, then feel free. And thanks again for everyone who entered.
Yes, thank you all. Well done, Andrea. And hopefully more time to be won very soon, as Miles says. Right, without further ado, let's get into it, shall we? So news this week. Phil, is there anything you wanted to cover off first of all? We've got a couple bits on the list, if not.
Not particularly. I did notice, I don't know if you saw on the news last night, that as a gunsmith's been had a data breach, and people who are owners of guns are really worried now because they feel they might be targeted by organised criminals coming to take whatever they've got in their locking cupboards, which again, quite a serious breach, isn't it? I think there's 10,000 on this database of gun owners. So that's quite worrying, isn't it?
It is. I didn't see that one. So is that UK-based or is that US?
Yeah, yeah. It's UK. You didn't think there were 10,000 guns in the UK, but no, it's on the BBC last night.
Oh, all right.
In fact, and this morning. Yeah, I noticed it this morning as I was having my cornflakes.
It is rather worrying, yeah, I guess it might depend what kind of gun you've got. If you want to register with a water pistol, you might be all right, but I'm assuming that they're going to be shotguns and all sorts on there.
I don't think you need to register, though. just looking at it now on the BBC, thousands of names and addresses belonging to UK customers of a leading website for buying and selling shotguns and rifles have been published to the dark web following a security breach. Guntrader.co.uk told the BBC it learned of the breach on Monday and notified the ICO and the Police and Organised Criminal National Crime Agency are investigating. So, serious.
Definitely. No, you go.
I was going to say, it certainly is. Is it just the, what kind of details
have been... 100,000 customer records were stolen.
And what kind of details? The home address and contact details as well, is it?
It doesn't say. No information relating to gun ownership or the location of firearms was taken, according to this, but don't know. Don't know. Makes me wonder what information was taken, if it wasn't actually relating to, the gun and where it was. Don't know.
Interesting. No, certainly interesting, though, isn't it? It's We'll watch that one. I think we'll see what might come out of that as it progresses. If you've got certain bodies involved, it's certainly interesting to see what might be the outcome.
But other than that, to be honest, I've been nose to the grindstone all week, and I haven't really been on top of the news, so I don't know what's been going on.
No, that's fair enough. It's interesting you mentioned that one. You said there that it's probably sort of quite logically so that incident has been reported to the police. I just thought that was interesting because I saw another incident this week, which Brian actually sent over to me this morning, which was a Danish incident where basically, to cut a long story short, a local council didn't sufficiently protect some of their records, and I think records relating to 30,000 children and particularly the psychiatric problems which affected them became publicly accessible. So they've been fined off the back of that. But the thing that sort of interests me in that, and it's the second time I've seen this in Denmark, is that they seem to report a lot of these incidents to the police, sort of tying into what we're saying, which I think is just sort of quite an interesting approach, because obviously you would only really do that in the UK in sort of very specific circumstances. I know we've done it once where one of our clients, a former employee, tried to blackmail them with some data that they've been siphoning off. So we said, well, you know, report it to the police, it's a criminal offence. But it's just interesting, it's a slightly different approach, I suppose, on the continent. But then again, I suppose that's something we should be used to.
Yeah. Another thing I did notice, Ollie, is I saw in Lexology quite a few references to the looming age-appropriate design code of conduct, a code of practice coming into effect. So again, the clock ticking down, there's only a couple months now until it takes effect. But yet there's still not much clarity as to who it applies to in the case of the education sector. You know, it's still unclear whether schools are caught by the requirements or not. And I have asked the ICO twice directly the question, they've avoided answering.
No, I was just going to add to that saying that I think we said some time ago, we're not sure exactly how proactively that's going to be enforced come September, so we'll have to see.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to mention, I circulated this round internally. I raised a subject access request in March on a mobile phone provider for one reason or another, and they completely ignored me. So after about 40 days, I reported them to the ICO. I did chase them twice. Anyway, the ICO, as they do, came back and said they'll assign a casework and they'll get round to it in 3 or 4 months' time. In the intervening period, the mobile phone provider has responded and provided with what I wanted. And I got a note from the ICO this week saying, right, we've assessed your case, you know, what's the latest on it? And I went back to the ICO and I said, well, you know, they've now satisfied my request, but, you know, they made me go through ID verification 3 times and made me fill in a form on a particular website. They wouldn't accept any other method of submitting a SAR. And altogether was really pain in the neck to work with. And they wrote back to me, said they're going to be writing to this network provider, telling them that their practices aren't good enough and they need to improve them. So it's interesting, you know, when you get something like that from the ICO, you think, well, actually, you know, you do it eventually. Take some action, but that was, I mean, you don't know the context, you don't know if they've had tons of complaints about this particular company or not, but it's always interesting to get some sort of closure, and I circulated it internally because it's not often we see that aspect of it.
No, for sure. It'd be interesting as well, because I always like putting in SARs occasionally just because they're there and you can try it just to kind of go through the process to see what the results are. But sometimes you're left wondering, even if they do find any favour, does it actually make the organisation change? Do they actually take it seriously and kind of go, well, the ICO said, well, we need to look at this, we will do, but the ICO didn't say that they want to see anything as verification that a process has changed within a period of time after their determination and stuff. So do you actually think it's got any great effects? You might have closure for yourself, but do you think organisations actually take it seriously as a result of that?
I don't know, Dave. You know, I can imagine that the kind of approach it took with me, that they'll just ignore it, I think.
Because we spend, because this is the point, because we spend a lot of our time, well, I spend a lot of my time telling people about the rights and privacy and we've got to take it all seriously and things, but it sometimes just feel like it's lacking with that kind of support from the ICO. You tell people you've got to be careful, the regulator might get involved, but if the regulator is rather toothless and they say, well, we've looked and yes, the baby didn't do it right and we've told them that they might need to behave themselves in future, that kind of stuff. It's not really an enforcement mechanism for organisations to just kind of sit up and listen, to kind of go, all right, something's grumbled in the corner, we'll just continue as we are.
Yeah,
for sure. I'm just seeing that someone's got their hand up. Unfortunately, I've only got an initial, so N, if you'd like to come on and contribute, please do. Apologies, I haven't got your first name there.
No, sorry, first name is Noel, but I think that was a mistake, sorry.
Oh, okay.
Put your hand up was a mistake. It's always a mistake when you put your hand up, believe me. That's how I got into this mess.
Sorry.
No problem. It's just I'm aware that we do rabbit on, so if ever there is a hand up, I do try and get to it and try and allow people to get a word in edgeways. Sorry, Dave, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say anyway. The point Phil raised kind of links into something I've seen recently. I don't know how new it is. I maybe should have noted it down before as part of my note taking when I was looking through this earlier. But did you notice, or did anybody come across the Liechtenstein Data Protection Authority gave some guidance or a case in relation to Article 15 to SARS? I don't think it actually tells us anything that we're not aware of, but it did say that the GDPR does not automatically include a copy of all documents in which the name of the data subject to appear. So I don't actually necessarily find that as groundbreaking. I think certainly from our SARS service, it's how we're used to dealing with stuff. We're well aware that SARS and the right of access is the right to access your personal data, not necessarily the document that it's in. So it's kind of supports what we've believed all along. But it's one of the questions from that is just understanding what problems people may be faced with SARS. And by way of an example, and by all means, Ollie and Phil, you feel free to jump in and answer if you like. But if you had an SAR, by way of an example, if you had an organisation that say it's a housing association, they get regular complaints about an individual, and that individual then puts in a subject access request, then you're trawling through all of those complaints trying to determine whether whether they're disclosable or not, bearing in mind some of the exemptions, bearing in mind some of the issues in relation to whether some of those complaints are potentially given under a common law duty of confidence and things. Would you find it acceptable to produce a table of complaints, for example? So the individual says, how many complaints have I had between, say, March and July? And you say, well, between March and July, you've had 15 complaints, and the breakdown is 5 was for noise and 3 was for smoking pot at the back of your house or anything otherwise. Would you find that as an acceptable approach? And it's just to see what people would generally do around those areas of SARS.
Yeah, I think it's fair enough. I think we've I know for a fact that you and I, Dave, have taken a similar approach to it previously. I saw that Lisa had a hand up. I don't know if you want to jump in there particular topic.
I was slightly on the earlier point about, you know, you don't have to give every single document, because we had a complainant who wrote to the ICO. We'd explained lots of times that we wouldn't have to give every single email that he was referenced in. But he did take it to the ICO on that on a number of other points. But they were clear when they wrote back to us and to him that we were compliant and it's his personal information, not every single document. Because I still think, even though it's clear to us as technicians, if you like, from a GDPR point of view, people out there still don't get that point. On the table point, the thing that I would say is we had some very complex.
Sorry, I've just. Is that me? I've just.
No,
Lisa's just
lost Lisa. Yeah, we've just lost Lisa.
Okay, well, at least if you can hear us and you do come back, do jump back in, because you
were raising
a couple of points. I just dropped out, I think. Yeah, so I was just saying, we did a table of interviews with a number of employees where we just then sort of referenced points made by employees within the interview. But we didn't set out, this was an interview, you know, for this particular thing, this was an interview with this particular person. We just pulled together the elements that touched on him and provided it that way. And again, we haven't been told, because he had some complaints about that as well, that that was inappropriate.
I think there's a really good couple of points in there. The first bit in relation to documents. I think just by the very nature of the work that we do when we're looking at SARs and redacting SARs, what we generally do is if the document's really got nothing much in it, obviously only a couple of pages, we redact bits out of it and get the document out of ease as opposed to the fact that they're entitled to it. And I'm not sure whether that sometimes gives a false impression to the individual or whether the individual that they're subject to or the requesters then kind of either from that or just their general thinking is, well, if it's got my name on it, I can have access to it. So I'd agree. I think there's probably an interpretation point there somewhere. That may lead to individuals believing that if the name's on it, that they can have it.
I just feel there's some people who just missed it.
So you said that again? No, I don't know.
Sorry, I thought somebody was trying to say something. I do apologise.
Yeah, likewise. No, it's no problem. I'm just keeping an eye on the chat, and there are some good points in there. I try and take them in the best order I can, but part of the problem is that we do have such a habit of rabbiting on that people contribute, and I don't quite have time to keep up with it. In relation to what you're saying there, Dave, and just to link back to the point that Phil was making, because I suppose it all ties in really about how seriously organisations actually take the ICO. Petra saying that... you know, we'd hope that most companies getting correspondence from the ICO would take it seriously. And then saying we certainly don't want to get on the radar when any authority feels they now have to start investigating a bit deeper. And I certainly sort of echo that. I saw a report this week, actually, which I found quite interesting. We were talking about earlier, Dave, that said that out of a representative sample of UK businesses, about 43% have now either reported themselves or been reported to the ICO over a breach since the introduction of the GDPR, rather, which is quite a high number, actually. There were some other interesting stats in that report. 9% of respondents said they weren't sure whether they had reported a breach or not, which is pretty damning as a representative sample. But no, certainly interesting. I noticed Rick put in a link about plans from the government to make digital identities as trusted as passports, which is interesting because we spoke about something vaguely related a couple months ago when I think from the European side they were trying to push to get vaccine passports implemented and digital vaccine passports. I think they call it the green certificate. And effectively that was pushed back on at the time because there'd basically been no DPIA completed by the organisation that put it forwards. But it is interesting because there's obviously a lot tied into this. I know that currently I have a QR code on my phone that acts as effectively a vaccine passport. I can scan that to go travelling should I want to. So, it's definitely interesting to see how that develops, how that all ties in. I don't know if either of you got any thoughts on that, but Phil's trying to flash something on screen there. I can't quite see what that is.
It's trying to get it in the right... It won't. I applied to the NHS for a COVID passport, and it comes as a letter form with a watermark all over it. I don't know if you've seen one before, but I can't seem to show it. But this is my vaccine passport, COVID passport.
Yeah, so I've got mine on my phone now, which is quite helpful. There's a lot of chat from the guys on the session about, and it's something that I think we mentioned this morning, about the potential delay in appointing a replacement to Elizabeth Denham. I don't know if either of you had any thoughts on that or anything you wanted to highlight.
I think there'll be big shoes to fill, and I think Phil will do a good job in filling them.
I'm not even aware there was a delay in appointing, apart from the obvious one, because you went to finish at the end of this month. But I didn't know there was a delay to it. What's it caused by? What's the jungle drum saying, Ollie?
I'm not entirely sure, to be honest. I've not really, I hadn't really spotted this week. I was aware that there was chatter about it, but I don't know what the implications are. And I don't know if anyone on the session wants to jump on and kick it around. I have seen, however, that Elizabeth Denham has come in for criticism again this week in wake of a number of homes being raided in the Matt Hancock CCTV debacle, let's call it. So obviously we all know what's happened on that front, that those CCTV images leaked. I don't need to go into any of that. But then I think this week two homes were raided off the back of that for computers and evidence. And then some less than reputable newspapers have started saying that it's a gross abuse of power from the ICO, and that it could deter whistleblowers from coming forwards, which I think we all sort of think is probably nonsense, to be honest. But the interesting part about that is Elizabeth Denham sort of categorically pushed back and said, no, we're just interested in ascertaining the facts in this. And in fact, we think that this won't constitute an offence under Section 170 of the Data Protection Act, so unlawfully obtaining data, because we think we might be able to rely on the public interest exemption to that. So that this disclosure or footage of Matt Hancock misbehaving is fundamentally in the public interest. I don't think they've made a decision as to that yet, but it's interesting to see that they might rely on that. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on it, but certainly a strong way to push back on those allegations.
It's been interesting, because it's always that balance, isn't it, between what's in the public interest and what's of interest to the public, and trying to get that kind of balance between the two. You could argue that he's still entitled to privacy and confidentiality. I know we spoke last week about this, Ollie, actually, didn't we, when we were looking at the homes being raided and issues about Matt Hancock, and not necessarily kind of saying, well, I'm in support of Matt Hancock or not in support of Matt Hancock, but ultimately, at the end of the day, we still best not lose sight of the fact that there's still families involved and there's still families broken up as a result of it, so it's still got a very human element to it in that sense. In addition to the debate on whether he's entitled to privacy as a public figure or lesser privacy as a public figure, in that kind of sense, whether the footage should have been controlled or not released in such a manner.
Interesting. Michael shared a link saying that, which effectively seems to say that the delay in appointing a new ICO is because it's a lack of suitable candidates, and partly also because there's been a delay to appointing the next chair of Ofcom, and that apparently has a knock-on effect, if I'm reading that right, which I may not be, admittedly, because I've just skimmed over it. Steph asking whether that might have an impact upon adequacy. I wouldn't have thought so. I don't know. I don't know if anyone's got any thoughts on that, but I can't imagine it would have a significant impact.
I wouldn't have thought so.
Interesting idea, though.
Well, the ICO is a figurehead, isn't she, for an independent organisation. So I wouldn't have thought, if you've got, she might even stay on, if you've got a vacancy, I don't think it would affect the ability of it to, for it to function. It might do, but I wouldn't have thought so. But a good thought.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah, interesting idea. There's a couple of bits also going into the chat. I'm afraid I'm struggling to keep up with them and steer the conversation, so you have to forgive me. I will get to them very shortly. In the meantime, speaking of the ICO, Dave, I know you and I were talking beforehand, and you said you've been looking into a trends report relating to the ICO. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was all quite interesting, to be fair. I was only reading what somebody else had published, and it relates to the ICO's annual report from 2020 to 2021 financial year and comparisons to previous years, just kind of see what the differences are. And there's just a couple of bits that kind of really stuck with me, really. So it says, ultimately, the vast majority of data breaches don't actually result in any further action. And there was a stat in there that only 0.1% results, so 0.1% of breaches that reported in the year resulted in a lower tier fine, which is an awfully low number, quite frankly, in that percent. But conversely, in there, it did state that just over a fifth, the 21.6% of all cases reported to the ICO resulted in investigation. Now, that investigation, quite frankly, from the stats, didn't result in much, but there's over a fifth of all breaches were investigated by the ICO. Now, you could look at that and kind of going, well, what's the impact of having an investigation by the ICO? Well, it can be quite intrusive. They can certainly be quite lengthy at times, on depending on the types of nature and the types of the investigation that they're going through. They could potentially cause resource diversion while you're trying to address the parts from the ICO. So I was kind of thinking, well, all right, so if you have a breach, what would be impacted? There's a kind of a 1 in 5, or just slightly a bit more than a 1 in 5 chance of it resulting in an investigation. Well, if you kind of start thinking, well, how do we minimise the impact of that on business? Not necessarily a data protection issue per se, but how do we minimise the impact of any investigation on the business? And then it comes back to DP when you start thinking, well, making sure that we've got Our framework's in place, making sure that our policies and procedures are there. In essence, looking at possibly trying to ensure that you can part your knowledge. So it's only a very rough acronym. So making sure your policies and procedures are in there. You've got some measure of accountability. You've got your ropes up to date, and you've got some demonstration of a training and suitable training in place for those involved. So you've got ready information available to provide, and that might end up kind of limiting or minimising. Or with the aim of at least minimising time that it may take, because these things can be lengthy and have business continuity issues, in the sense that we can't continue as we are because I'm having to spend time addressing something else. And it's just looking at the impact from that. And it's like I said, maybe more of a moot point, but I just found it quite interesting kicking around a few ideas that if you've had a breach and there's a fifth of a chance of it resulting in some action from the ICO, then what are you going to do to prepare should you face action from the ICO? Stood into finance. I know. Who would have thought? Such insight. that's kind of where my mind was going when I was kind of kicking around some of those ideas. But it's quite partly interesting to see that fifth of all breaches results in some form of investigatory measure by the ICO. And then the ICO severely lets themselves down by only issuing at least in the lower tier fines. In the region of 0.1% of all issues. So from those stats, you can certainly see why the European Parliament criticised the inactivity of the ICO over the time.
Very crackly going on.
Just bear with me a second, I'll find out whose mic is up there now.
There we go. Sorry about that. No. in a car wash, yeah, quite possibly.
Sorry about that, guys. I was in the convertible Beamer.
Were you now?
No, I'm joking. It's just when you're saying car wash, I just had this image of going through a car wash in a convertible Beamer, but no, it wasn't me. I'm sat at home in my sweatbox.
I was just while you were running through that, Dave, just checking through the articles that Rick and Michael have posted into the chat, both very interesting, both sort of in relation to that public interest line that we were discussing previously. One of those talking about a proposed changes to the Official Secrets Act, which could basically bring in sort of more severe punishment for journalists leaking secrets or information. I'd say there's a line in this that really catches me off guard, and I may be reading this incorrectly. There's a quote here that says that the Home Office said it does not consider there is necessarily a distinction in severity between espionage and the most serious unauthorised disclosures. Really? It seemed quite an odd line to take.
Say that again.
The Home Office said that it does not consider that there is necessarily a distinction in severity between espionage and the most serious unauthorised disclosures. I might be reading that incorrectly, but that seems like a really odd quote to me. There it is. And then Rick shared an article which sounds very dystopian and frightening about effectively a priest, a senior priest, I think, in the US being outed as gay. And they did so by effectively compiling data on him from his comings and goings to gay bars and using the app Grindr. Incredibly intrusive and... Yeah, very dystopian. Not sure about that. Not sure I like the sound of that at all. Anyway, one topic I did want to pick up this week, actually, is one that we were kicking around in the office earlier, which is the concept of representatives under Article 27, right? We were talking about this earlier in the week, Phil.
Yeah, we were, weren't we? Yeah.
Which I think is actually quite an interesting concept. I think it's probably worth kicking around a bit. So basically the premise is that obviously now we've left the EU, we are technically a third country, and where we are caught by the provisions of Article 3.2, I think, we will be caught by the territorial scope of the GDPR, and we may, in accordance with Article 27, have to appoint a representative. That's broadly it, isn't it, Phil?
Yeah, broadly. So, but it's...
Broadly.
the devil's in the detail, isn't it? So I got onto this week because I have a customer who is supplying services to a processor, who's supplying services to a controller right across the world. They're doing surveys, basically. So the controller uses this platform to do the surveys, and our client is basically creating the surveys and analysing the results. So because they're providing their services into the EU, well, they're not. But I think because they're part of a chain of activity that's effectively monitoring behaviour in the EU, where the behaviour takes part of the EU, it looks like they're caught by the territorial scope, Article 3.2 of the GDPR, and therefore the requirement to put in place a representative. But I had to do a few hours of research and go back to the paper that the European Data Protection Board wrote a few years ago now on the territorial scope and representatives. But like everything in this thing, it's down to what we're doing monitoring, you know, and it's really unclear because, again, the examples it gives are really obvious things for monitoring and not specifically clear about what my client's doing. So, I mean, I said, you know, I was saying, well, you probably need to err on the side of caution, and you've come up with some inventive solutions for your clients who are needing to put representatives in place. But that was what it boiled down to. It's quite interesting actually reading the territorial scope piece again because it helps to, you know, articulate what Article 3.2 is trying to do, you know, about providing goods and services into the EU or monitoring behaviour in the EU. And then as a byproduct of that, you know, it talks about processes and controls. Because it was a bit of a strange one to me. I was thinking, well, you know, if this is just a processor, then they can't, you know, they can control that processing. They're just doing what they're told. Therefore, yeah, why would you want a representative? Because the supervisory authority could approach a controller who has to have a representative or an establishment. So I started off thinking, oh, that seems a bit bonkers, this. And then having read through all the guidance, you know, the guidance quite clearly states that even processors providing services are part of a chain have to have a representative. Anyway, that was an interesting couple of hours for me.
No, it's tricky. You're right, because I had to look at, for as you say, one of my clients who effectively provide a piece of software to a couple of institutions in Europe. But I think the crux of it for us, when I was looking at it, and my issue was slightly different than yours, I suppose, because you're saying that really it was whether being caught up in that chain actually constitutes taking part in the activity, I suppose, and therefore being caught. Our issue was more that we looked at it and we weren't necessarily sure that the territorial scope really, I mean, far from me to question how it's been worded or designed, but it didn't really seem to work in our context because fundamentally, you know, we just provided a piece of software to institutions, I say, on the continent. And really, if anyone had an issue with that piece of kit, they'd have taken it with the institution directly. They wouldn't take it with us or our client, rather. So it seemed a little bit odd for us to actually have to go to the lengths of appointing a representative in the union. In the end, as you mentioned, we came up with a slightly creative solution. And I'm perfectly happy to have this challenged by anyone here. But effectively what we did, because it was only a small number of clients, we put in writing the fact that we were appointing our client as the representative. So saying, effectively, it was cementing the fact that there'd be a glorified PO box for anyone on the continent that had an issue with the processing that our client was carrying out. Really, it was little more than that. So if a regulator or a data subject had an issue, they'd speak to the client. The client would then, in turn, speak to our client, the processor. So, you know, I mean, that we think that stands up. We think it works. We've got it written into contract. There's a mandate there, as required by Article 27. But, I mean, more broadly, if you're an SME and you're asked to appoint a representative, it seems, particularly in circumstances like the ones we're describing, so you're a processor in the UK and you know, do business with controllers in Europe and you maybe provide a piece of software or something. I can't help but think that it seems somewhat onerous and a little bit disjointed, if anything. Doesn't really seem to work. I don't know. I might be wrong, but certainly an interesting topic anyway. I don't know, Dave, if you wanted to chip in on that at all.
Yeah, I can remember working with you on it, Ollie, and it was one of those things that seems a bit odd, doesn't it? Because when you're a processor, so for example, if you had a breach as a processor, you tell the controller. If you had a rights request as a processor, you would tell the controller. So you'd have thought the first point of call for any form of representation will be the controller, not necessarily the processor. Because it all seems to be kind of geared that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
I think with what you've come up with, is workable. It's in essence kind of going, well, if you've got a problem, then these are the people you talk about and these are the people who'll be able to deal with it. But in essence, they just pass it on, in that sense. But as a processor, like you say, it's this kind of imbalance where, it would appear that the processor operating outside of Europe, but services in Europe will need some kind of representative. When you thought ultimately that responsibility should rest with the, rest with the controller.
Yeah, you'd have thought so. I noticed Rick mentioned in the chat. I don't know if you want to come on, Rick. I know you're not always available to, but please do. If you are, mention the NSO spyware use/leak this week. I don't know if either of you picked up on that, Dave and Phil, but it's effectively the news that, as far as I'm aware, it's an Israeli company that does this piece of spyware that it's mostly, I think, you know, foreign governments are likely to use or government agencies across the world, and they make a really big deal about the fact they only sell it to sort of legitimate bodies who have got legitimate targets that are maybe of a terrorist nature or whatever. But this story came out this week, and as far as I understood it was basically saying that this piece of kit was used far more broadly than anyone thought at this point. And the company's stance to it is that they're baffled because they say that they've never even had 10,000 customers on record, and yet we're talking about, I think, something like 500,000 records. So they're pushing back on it on that basis. I've not really seen enough, to be honest, to be able to formulate a properly informed opinion. But if true, it's certainly worrying.
Yeah, Ollie, what I was going to say, to me, it's almost like a, you know, massive human rights breach, because there's no accountability, there's no safeguards in place. You know, the potential for it reaching across the entire globe, and, you know, they're looking at random journalists anywhere in the world, just to me seems terrifying. You know, and obviously this information is then kept on, you know, records for, you know, who knows how long. And then, I mean, one of the things I was worrying or wondered about really is that did the person that leaked this information, will they get treated the same as Snowden?
Yeah.
It's a massive issue.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's interesting, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, the article I read on it sort of instantly linked it to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, because I believe that the Saudis had used this piece of kit on him, I think, or at least there's an allegation of that. So that was the link that was instantly made in the piece I read on it. But no, absolutely spot on, terrifying. Yeah, interesting to see how it develops. Rightio. The only other bit I had to discuss this week, and Phil and Dave, if there's anything that you wanted to kick around, then please do. But the only other bit is that I mentioned this morning on our weekly catch-up call that I've been still grappling with standard contractual clauses and actually trying to get some implemented with one of my clients and their suppliers abroad, which frankly hasn't been easy at all. It's been quite burdensome. And actually, there's a huge degree of confusion around what set of clauses we should even be using and when we might have to change those. So I thought it was possibly worth kicking that around, if that's all right with you two.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a complicated process. The way because we were talking about this the other week, Phil, and I was effectively saying that there seems to be no reason why you couldn't have a set of standard contractual clauses which also fulfilled the requirements of Article 28 for your processor clauses, because a lot of them match up fundamentally. Most of it's already there. Probably need to supplement it slightly, and of course we can do that as long as we don't take anything out. So it seems reasonable to do it. However, one of the first things I came across when I was doing this is the ICO categorically stating that you have to have two separate contracts, which first of all seems unnecessary and like a bit of a burden, quite frankly. And the second thing is that not only are we not supposed to use the new European set of clauses, we're meant to use the old set that the ICO has customised, their sort of own brand version of them. And the document itself, I don't know if anyone has had a play with it yet, or been forced to play with it as I have over the last week to get some clauses implemented, but it's probably quite user-friendly if you don't know what you're doing in regards to international transfers, but it really felt like it hindered me quite significantly. So there's a guidance note against every single clause in the contract, and there's a guidance note against every single field, and you have to go through endless checklists, and it weirdly actually doesn't even spend particularly long weighing up the importance of supplementary measures. I suppose it wouldn't, because different regime now technically, but not easy to use in all honesty. And then having to go through the process as well of establishing security measures with the supplier is not particularly streamlined. And I don't know if anyone had any thoughts on that, any tips perhaps, anyone been confronted with it yet?
I haven't. I'm obviously aware of them, but the clients that I work with haven't caused me to pull on the new standard, has it?
Yeah, I suppose it's a funny one, because 90% of the time when I deal with international transfers on behalf of a client, it's with someone that's like Microsoft or, you know, AWS or one of these sort of really large organisations that will have some contractual clauses in place already built into their standard terms and conditions. So actually having to go through the process of doing it yourself, you know, is quite sort of, intriguing. It feels, to be honest, quite potentially onerous, particularly for SMEs, when we talk about the sort of standards that have to be in place. And it did sort of prompt me to think how much that would be enforced, actually, if you decide you were going to use the new European ones in place, the ones the ICO are recommending, whether they'd even really have that much of a leg to stand on. I suppose obviously they would, or they'd find one, but it just prompted me to sort of query that.
Did the, when you were looking at Oli, did the ICO give any indication as to whether they'll basically be accepting the European standards, whether they'll be rewriting their own versions? And if they are going to rewrite their own versions, what will be the outcome if you've already moved over to the European standard?
No outcome as of yet, as far as I'm aware. They are currently rewriting the new European set, the modular ones, which I'll be honest, part of the reason it's taken me so long is initially I went off and started modifying them, and only then realised, once I found an obscure web page from the ICO, that they don't allow you to do that, apparently. But they're currently working on their own set of those to be implemented. They've not said, as far as I'm aware, what happens when they do come out with those, whether we have to repaper all our contracts again or whether they're allowed the old set to stand. I genuinely don't know at this stage. And I don't know how closely they'll align themselves with the European standard, because obviously those new European ones take into account a lot of what came out of Schrems too, didn't it? So there's a huge amount of work put into supplementary measures and into ensuring essential European guarantees. But I don't know how much we'll align ourselves with that. To be seen.
No, absolutely. I'd like to think from a pragmatic point that they might just accept them to help things be aligned, as opposed to... because you could potentially foresee there being a difficulty or a disjoint between a UK stance and a European stance. So then in that situation, would you end up having to have two different sets where there's conflict? Yeah. You know what I mean? You could just envisage that happening. if in essence, for no other reason, then you've got an anti-European government in Parliament, in that sense, in the sense, well, we'll just go against it because we can and we should, as opposed to actually looking pragmatically. But it could end up getting quite a bit of a mess if you've got two different standards that are slightly different in elements. In that sense, and I would have thought pragmatically, just to review them, and if the same fit for purpose and acceptable, just to accept them.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good point. It's exactly what Rick's saying, which is if you're dealing control between US, UK and EU entities, whether you need to do two sets, which at this moment in time, potentially you would have to, I think. I don't think the Europeans would be too bothered. but the UK might, again, it depends how much the ICO intends to enforce it. I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. To be honest, the whole idea that we've done our own set of SCCs, the old ones, and you have to use those, maybe I'm being a bit unfair, but it does sort of feel a bit like political posturing, to be honest, in this sort of post-Brexit sort of train of thought that we've seen a little bit. I mean, Petra makes a really good point, which is that obviously we're going to have to remain aligned to some degree because of adequacy status. But again, that's sort of a tricky one because we've repeatedly seen statements out of the UK government saying that we're going to try and move away as far as we can from European standards, haven't we? We've, you know, Darden and the, I can never remember the name of the department that's in charge of it. What is it? Culture, Media, Sport. Is that the one? DCMS?
It is, yeah.
Sort of these statements saying that, oh, well, we're going to weaponize our data and we want to, you know, create a data economy and the ICO will be, you know, taking a backseat effectively. I swear I saw something to that effect recently. So, I mean, we'll have to see. I suppose there's no clear-cut answer, but...
Now you've mentioned that, I actually agree with you. I'd read somewhere very briefly, I should have noted it, about some commentary that the UK could in essence be a tax haven, but instead a data haven.
Yes.
I don't know if you saw that as well. Who knows what's going to happen in the future? It could all change tomorrow. But it really wouldn't be very pragmatic, I wouldn't have thought. But it's, I'd seen that, now you've mentioned that, possibly a few weeks ago now. I don't know, the day seems a blur, but possibly a few weeks ago when that popped up.
Yeah, you're spot on. But it's a weird one, that, the idea of a data haven. I mean, would that even theoretically be possible? Because if you... You're sort of a risk there of excluding yourself of dealing with Europe, because if Europe's sticking to the GDPR, which is obviously, you know, the highest standard in terms of these things, and you're going, nah, we're not worried about the GDPR, come here and do wonderful things with your data that you're not allowed to do in Europe, well, surely that puts a bit of a spanner in the works in terms of your dealings with said continent. I don't know. It just seems like a bit of a weird concept to me. I'm not sure it necessarily works.
Well, if one thing, it'll certainly keep us all employed until we retire.
Yeah, well, we'd hope so.
Trying to get a head around all the changes and what it may mean and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. Michael's just shared the article, which was the one that I read, which is absolutely fantastic. Thanks, Michael. This is where it was, which is an article from Carissa Phillips in The Guardian, which is a very interesting piece on how this national data strategy fits in. That's where I'd read it. Thanks, Michael. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. I don't know if there's anything else that you chaps wanted to talk about. I don't know if there's anything that anyone...
I wanted to talk about... I did a great piece of training this week for a customer on security awareness, particularly phishing. So thank you for helping put that together, Ollie. But in that, I went onto YouTube and I found some brilliant videos of this guy called Jim Browning, who kind of reverse engineers the hackers, and he's hacked into the CCTV systems of this spam contact center in Delhi. And then he rings them up, because he says, I've got this issue on my computer. And then he's watching them on the screen, and it's absolutely fascinating. So again, there's some really good training material out there. I haven't created it. I just nicked it to use in the training session. Then we did some talking around it, the way to protect yourself, et cetera. But there's lots of good resources out there. If you want to do anything on, on phishing particularly, on phishing, that's a particularly good, source of stuff. So I want you to throw that out there. But I want to talk about audits, because Dave's been auditing this week and I'm auditing next week with Matthew. And I just wanted to kind of ask really what Dave's found, whether he's found a significant difference from the last time he did an audit, or last year and the year before, whether we're finding the same issues, whether we're finding that there's been a bit more maturity around things in organisations. So I was keen to just kind of pick up on that and kick it around. And what I found in the prep, my audit is Tuesday, Wednesday, and then Dave's actually doing a physical audit on Thursday. But I've asked for policies and procedures and the ROPAs in advance. And you know, I'm getting pushback, so we haven't really got much. And then, you know, the client is saying, I want you to talk to all the different departmental heads. And I'm saying, well, I'm not really interested in talking to them until I've spoken to the person who's responsible for data protection compliance management, because I want to assess the framework and the environment first before I then go out and test it by talking to your colleagues. So in that particular case, I'm thinking, well, that doesn't appear to be any progress from the 2016 pre-GDPR days. But what have you found, Dave, this week?
Yeah, this week with the audit, it was rather interesting because they've actually got a lot of really good stuff in place. There were holes in it, but they certainly had a lot of good stuff in place. They had a framework in place. They had a rope in place, both for the part of the organisation where it's a controller, so of employees' data, and also for the acting as a processor. So they had the framework in place. There's a couple of gaps in the framework. It's not necessarily scary gaps, but a couple of gaps. And the need to finalise it, they were moving the move from one system to another system for managing ropers and bits and pieces, and the need to make sure it's all up to date and used properly. So from the outset, they certainly had a good set of policies, good set of procedures in place, and the set of ropers. The focus, however, I think, splits into a couple of ways. One, because they're a big processor, the focus seems to have been on the side of the company that was processing. So we needed to make sure all our security was there because the big clients that they've got have insisted it. So the data protection compliance and the security compliance was there from that side of it. So they've got all the 27001 and the 9001 and there's another ISO standard that they had in place as well. And that kind of certainly came through. So there's that kind of split between, well, this is data, this is stuff we have to protect. And there's a lesser, not massively less, but lesser kind of focus on employee data. In that sense, and trying to find out what you're doing with and where it goes, and have we got appropriate control measures around, in essence, a Teams and SharePoint that might become a bit of a dumping ground, that kind of thing. So there's certainly a split in that direction. And then there was a split as well, kind of a perceivable split between security. As I mentioned, they needed all the security measures in there because some of their big clients insist you need to have X, Y, and Z, that kind of thing. But there was a kind of a focus on data protection means security, and kind of probably less focus on things like privacy and privacy management and that kind of thing. So it's kind of a split there as well. So it's quite interesting to see that from quite a mature setup when they were being analysed. And I just found it quite interesting, really, to kind of see those kind of divisions coming up where the sole focus is we need to make sure that we've got our accreditations in place, we meet our accreditations. But as you know, if you focus solely on accreditations, then all you do is meet a standard that you're trying to align to. You're not necessarily meeting all of the requirements of the law. very interesting in that sense.
Oh, right. Good stuff. Good stuff. So I'm looking forward to doing that. I've done a GDPR audit for some time, and it'd be good fun doing it with Matthew, I think.
Yeah, I think it'd be great, Matthew's kind of exposure and kind of progressing up through the ranks, as it were. So it's always interesting to see, isn't it? It's always interesting to see different bits and pieces. Everybody in the audit was really engaged. The other thing that was quite interesting as well was a slight disjoint between the DPO doing the DPO's gig, technically, and there's a resourcing issue anyway, but the DPO doing the DPO gig and feeling that there's a resource issue, potentially a slight conflict of interest issue. And when I spoke to the CEO, that he felt actually everything's fine. So there's a little mismatch between potentially what you've got and how you should be using them and what the DPO feels.
Right. Oh, well, looking forward to that. So, I just wanted to kind of kick that off again, really, that discussion. But what we've done in preparing all these, just kind of review all of our templates and the prerequisites again, and it's been quite a good exercise to pick them back out of the document repository and have a review through them. Made a few tweaks, you know, as you do.
All right, good stuff. On that front, Michael's asking whether you tend to align that process with what's required for ISO 27701.
No, because it's not comprehensive enough. I mean, it's pretty good that we developed our own audit methodology quite a few years ago, which, to be fair, was loosely based on the ICO's audit handbook, which they published in 2001, which is a really good document still, and you can get it. I've got a PDF version of it, so everybody wants it. You know, 166 pages. It's really good. It's got checklists in the back, and it's got audit methodology in the front. It's a good publication they produced. So, because we've been doing this a long time, we started auditing to our own hybrid methodology, you know, around 2005-06. But we used that as a substantial document to pick from. And then a bit later on, we reviewed British Standard 10,012 and picked a bit from that as well. And then we reviewed everything and changed it to accommodate the GDPR. And then 27701 came out, what, last year, the year before, and we haven't aligned with that. Dilip's done the audit training for 27701, but because it's requires 27001 and a lot of the controls are in 27001, I think, I don't think it's comprehensive enough personally. So it doesn't, you know, we're looking at the ICO registration, which is a minor point, but that's not, I don't think, required in 7701. We look at the PECA application. We look at the HP design of practice, you know, if it's applicable. So I think our audit is more extensive. But I might be wrong. And I have to have a look at the, again, at the requirements of 27701 and just do a benchmarking exercise. But another point in relation to this, Ollie, is that I've got to attend on behalf of one of our clients an audit. They're getting audited by one of their customers. So again, they're a processor. And this company is sending in a professional audit team to go and crawl all over the data protection compliance management measures. And I think they're in a reasonable shape, but anyway, they want me to sit in on to kind of manage that audit process. But I'm really, you know, encouraged to see that, because I'm a great advocate of get out and see what it's like. Don't just do a questionnaire, you know, commission someone to go and have a look and you know, feedback on what they find. That is good due diligence. But I mean, again, this company is doing a big job managing lots of data, you know, across the world. And, you know, some of it's quite sensitive stuff. So I guess it's taking a risk-based approach, you know, high-risk stuff. So put an auditor out on the site.
No, agreed. I'd like to see more of that, ideally. Excellent. Well, plenty of people liking the idea of you sharing that ICO audit handbook.
I'll stick it in. So, thing in and...
Yeah, but if not, Rob's redirected them to the support inbox. So yeah. I'm sure we can get that out to those who need it. Just as a final point on this, Michael saying that he's looking at implementing 27701 and wondered whether it would help with the DP audit, which I think it certainly wouldn't hurt, would it?
No, we can do a mock audit, you know, against 27701, but because you can do a standalone audit, but, you know, we can, but when it comes to your certification visit, it has to be, because it's inextricably linked with 27001, you have to do both, you know, so there is no such thing as a 27701 independent certification. It's an add-on to 27001, but we could certainly do an audit. But some of the controls are in 27001. That's the point, really. So you have to pick the controls that are in 27001 that apply over 27701, and then you've got to audit the controls in 27701. Anyway, we can have a conversation about that separately if it helps.
No worries. I think we've actually got an audit session lined up at some point in the future anyway. So we can get back to that in due course. I'm going to quickly finish up with an outro here, because one of my neighbours decided to do some drilling. So apologies if you can hear any of that coming through. So I think that's going to be it for this week. We've already hit the half hour mark already, or the hour mark. Thank you, Dave and Phil, as ever, for your contributions. Much appreciated.
You're welcome. And thank you.
Yep, thank you. And most of all, thank you everyone for joining, as ever. We really like these sessions. We think it's a really great space to kick things around. Quite frankly, I'm increasingly using them to crowdsource opinions on things. I'll admit to that. So yeah, no, it's always really great. Thanks for all the interaction. Thanks for everyone for joining. We'll be back again next week. I think, to be honest, Miles, I'm not entirely sure what the next session is. Do you want to fill us in?
Yeah, we've got to DPIA or not to DPIA next week.
Lovely.
Oh, I'm on holiday next week.
Yeah, lucky you.
I know. Traveling over to Anglesey this time next week, which will be nice.
Very nice.
Lovely.
Is that what you needed your COVID passport for, Phil?
Well, just in case.
And, in the meantime, Dave and I are going to have to think about DPIAs then, aren't we? If it's going to be the two of us. But, we look forward to seeing you all. Yeah, we'll be fine. We look forward to seeing you all next week. And, have a lovely weekend until then. Take care, all.
Take care, everybody. Thanks much. Bye-bye.